Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the social psychologist and social activist, Dr. Melanie Joy. Melanie is perhaps most well known for coining the term carnism, which she popularized in her book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs and Wear Cows. She is the founder and president of Beyond Carnism, a charitable organization which she founded in 2010, and carnism will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Melanie. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Okay, well, could we begin, Melanie, by you telling us something about your background and perhaps what prompted you to dedicate much of your life's work to this challenge?
Certainly. My life's work, probably like many people's life's work, has emerged from my own personal life experience to a very large degree. Like many people, I grew up with a dog who I cared about deeply. I loved my dog like a family member. Yeah. I also was a person who certainly cared about all animals and didn't want them to suffer. And I grew up as a person who cared very much about social justice. Social justice has always been really central to my life. And I grew up eating animals, eating meat, eggs, and dairy on a regular basis, like most people. And for much of my life, I just never made the connection, between the meat on my plate, for example, and the living being it once was. I never thought about how strange it was that I could pet my dog with one hand while I ate a pork chop with the other, you know, a pork chop that had once been an animal who was at least as sentient and certainly as intelligent, if not more so, than my dog. So I had an experience one day when I was 23 where I ate a contaminated hamburger. I got extremely ill. I wound up in the hospital and I swore off meat after that, not for any ethical reasons at the time, but more I just became disgusted by the idea of eating meat. And somehow when I stopped eating animals, I became more receptive to information about animal agriculture. And it was information that had always been out there. It had been always, you know, right in front of me. But I think when I was still invested in continuing to eat animals, I was not willing to actually see that information and really take it in. And what I learned shocked and horrified me. I learned about a global atrocity that has caused more bloodshed than all wars, famines, and natural disasters combined. And I was aware that I had been an active participant in enabling this atrocity. It was so counter animal agriculture, what was happening to the animals and the environment and to human consumers was so antithetical to my own personal values. Yeah. And yet I had been actively contributing to this throughout my life. And I realized at that point that I had to not only become a conscientious objector, but that I had to really understand how it had been possible for me to be blind to what was right in front of me for so many years. And for so many people who, like myself, are compassionate people with a strong sense of justice to nonetheless enable this atrocity. And so that was really what led me to do my research and to study the psychology of nonviolence, and in particular, the psychology of eating animals.
Okay. So what is carnism then, Melanie?
Well, this was, you know, my studies, my research, my doctoral research essentially led me to the discovery of what I came to call carnism. So, you know, carnism is the invisible ideology or belief system that conditions us to eat certain animals. It's essentially the opposite of veganism. And when I was doing my research, I interviewed vegans and vegetarians and meat eaters and meat cutters and butchers and even people who had raised and killed their own animals for food. And what I discovered was that everybody who was participating in this system that I came to call carnism had the same sorts of ambivalent or contradictory attitudes and behaviors toward farmed animals. You know, so they cared about animals. They loved certain species and other species they thought of as food and really disconnected empathically from those individuals. And so what I realized is that there was this it was a widespread prejudice, essentially, against farmed animals. And that only exists within a widespread ideology. So I realized there was something much more going on than simply individual attitudes and behaviors toward animals.
You mentioned, like earlier on, your dog. We have a very embodied connection with dogs. We've actually evolved in many ways together over the last sort of 15, 20,000 years. Maybe arguably to a similar extent to pigs and cats. We've lived together, but we've not had this bond in the same way that we have with dogs.
Well, I mean, there are many people who have the same kind of a bond with pigs and chickens and individuals of other species. It's just a question of what's become normalized. And, you know, I would suggest we know today, we have evidence today that humans are, in fact, hardwired to empathize. The fairly recent discovery of mirror neurons, you know, neurons in our brains that are activated when we witness others having an experience and that are activated in the same regions of our brains that would be activated if we were having that experience ourselves. These mirror neurons demonstrate that we're really hardwired to empathize with others. And so when we eat animals, we really need to disconnect from that natural empathy. We really need to shut down our awareness so that we can disconnect from that natural empathy. So I would suggest that it's not that we have learned to care about dogs, for example, but that rather we have learned not to care about individuals of other species.
Okay. How is carnism compatible with speciesism? Something that's promoted particularly by the philosopher Peter Singer, the pioneering campaigner for animal rights.
Yeah, well, speciesism is essentially the ethos or the backdrop that enables carnism. You know, speciesism is discrimination against species. You know, it's placing species in a hierarchy with humans, of course, at the top of that hierarchy. Carnism, you could say, is a sub-ideology of speciesism in a similar way that anti-Semitism, for example, is a sub-ideology of racism.
Okay, right, now I've got that. Well, could we try and unpack some of the core themes in a bit more detail? For example, could we start with how carnism is defended? You talk about denial, for example.
Sure. I mean, carnism is, it's very important to recognize a couple of features of carnism, as it were. Carnism is a dominant system. It's a dominant ideology, right? So that means it's institutionalized. It's essentially woven through the very structure of society to shape norms, laws, beliefs, behaviors, etc. And it is therefore internalized. When we're born into an institutionalized or a dominant system such as carnism, we absorb its logic as our own. We look at the world through the lens of carnism. So carnism is a dominant system, and it's also a violent system. It's meat cannot be procured without violence. And today, the egg and dairy industries are arguably the most brutal of all carnistic industries. So carnism actually runs counter to core human values, you know, values such as compassion and justice. You know, most people would not willingly support intensive and extensive violence toward other sentient beings. And so systems such as carnism need to use a set of, I refer to them as defense mechanisms. They're social and psychological defense mechanisms that distort our thoughts and numb our feelings, disconnect us from our natural empathy, so that we act against these core values without fully realizing what we're doing.
Okay, and it also keeps its victims out of sight, doesn't it?
Yes, and so one of the defense mechanisms, which you mentioned already, is denial. It's probably the main defense of the system. You know, we deny carnism by denying that there's a problem in the first place. I mean, if we deny there's a problem in the first place, then we don't have to do anything about it. We also deny carnism or deny the problem by keeping its victims out of sight and therefore conveniently out of public consciousness. I mean, 77 billion farmed animals are slaughtered globally every year for their flesh and other body parts. And this is only land animals. If we were to include fish and other aquatic species, I mean, this number could be quintupled. And yet the vast majority of us almost never encounter any of these individuals. I mean, if we do, we see like a few, you know, cows sprinkled across a hillside somewhere.
And there are other victims too, including ourselves. Isn't it right that there's increasing evidence to suggest that people who actually work in slaughterhouses, because you were talking about empathy and before, that because they have to repress their compassion and empathy, this can have negative mental side effects too.
Absolutely. I mean, the meat industry was, in the United States anyway, it was the only industry that was criticized by the organization Human Rights Watch for working conditions so appalling that they violate basic human rights. I mean, this industry, it's not surprisingly, treats its human animals terribly, just as it treats its non-human animals. And these people who are working in slaughterhouses and meatpacking plants are, you know, not only exploited in their jobs, but they're essentially working in a death-saturated environment. They're slaughtering individuals who don't want to be slaughtered day in and day out, all day long. And it doesn't take a psychologist to imagine the level of psychic numbing or disconnection that that requires and the psychological toll that that takes on, can take on someone.
Sure, yeah, I can imagine. And then you go on to talk about certain entrenched justifications that go pretty much unchallenged. And you talk about the three N's. Could we just briefly go through them?
Right. So I talk about, so denial being the main defense of the system, and then justification being another set of defenses. And I talk about, justification is essentially presenting the myths of meat, eggs, and dairy as though they are the facts of meat, eggs, and dairy. I mean, when we learn from, you know, our culture about eating animals, eating meat, eggs, and dairy, we assume that what we're learning is a set of facts rather than a set of widely held opinions.
Yeah.
And so the three ends of justification, all of these myths fall under what I refer to as the three ends of justification. Eating animals is normal, natural, and necessary. You know, not surprisingly, arguments that have been used to justify everything from slavery to male dominance.
Yeah. Thinking about natural as well, don't you think it's also important not to accept a fixed idea of what we are, but to work from that to become something better? You know, like as self-conscious creatures, we're not in the position of carnivores like cats or dogs, who cannot reflect on the alternatives to their dietary habits. You know, we almost have we arguably have a responsibility to use our awareness and consider the consequences of our actions in eating meat of a kind which we could not attribute to cats and dogs.
Well, we also, unlike cats and dogs and carnivores, we're not carnivores. And one could argue that we're omnivores. We can ingest both flesh and plant matter. But, you know, unlike other animals, we also have a choice. Many people in the world today, I mean, not everybody, some people are geographically unable to make their food choices freely, or they're economically disadvantaged. But many people in the world today do not eat animals because they need to. They eat animals because they have learned to. And we do have a choice. We can choose to eat differently. This is not a matter of survival for us the way it is for other carnivores. If a cat doesn't, you know, or if a lion doesn't eat other animals, that lion's going to die. If we don't eat other animals, well, the evidence today suggests that we're probably less likely to die.
Just another question about the natural argument. I mean, perhaps it could be interpreted charitably as meaning that we are well adapted for eating meat. But then again, this is not entirely true. For although we possess some, you know, rather limited canine teeth, our digestive systems are certainly not well adapted to a diet high in meat, are they? I mean, even if it were, that this would not amount to a moral argument. A man may or woman may be well adapted to be an efficient assassin, but that does not make his murders justified, does it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the real issue with the natural argument. I mean, the argument that something is natural has been used to justify all sorts of atrocities. I mean, it was one of the primary driving arguments in the Holocaust, for example. And we have to be very, very careful with how we understand and how we use this term. Typically, we define what's natural through the lens of the dominant culture. So when we look at history through the lens of carnism, we're looking at carnistic history, essentially. You know, and this argument doesn't, you know, the carnistic argument that eating animals is natural is based on the assumption that because we've done it for so long, it's what we're supposed to be doing today.
Yeah.
However, I mean, we've been murdering each other for just as long. We've been raping each other for just as long. And nobody today would use that argument to justify the continuation of such practices.
Sure, yeah. There was a series of studies done last year by psychologists in the US and Australia that appear to have backed up your thesis. Do you know anything about that, and whether they have also brought anything to light that you were previously not aware of?
Are you referring to the article that was in Appetite about the four ends of justification?
Yeah.
Yeah, they added a fourth N. Eating animals is nice. So eating animals tastes good. And this is an N that's organized around tradition. I mean, I would consider this potentially an aspect of eating animals as normal, but their argument, which makes a lot of sense to me, is that the taste factor is one of the motivators for people to continue eating animals. Although, again, today we have such, I mean, there in many places in the world today, the vegan alternatives to carnistic products are so realistic. That it's almost impossible or impossible to tell the difference between vegan meats and non-vegan meats. And vegan foods are, even the non kind of like the not meat foods, just whole foods, whole vegan foods are very tasty and becoming more and more widely accessible.
Sure. I mean, in my experience, actually, Melody, I don't know if this nice one is the most entrenched, but it seems to be, if I'm at dinner or something and the subject comes up, this is often the one that I've experienced that people, well, they say, well, because I like it, it tastes nice. And I suppose it's not, it's not a trivial argument in the sense that it's a brute psychological fact of large proportions. But I think, as you said, isn't this enjoyment just purely a matter of conditioning? We have very adaptable palates.
And I wonder about the nice argument. I mean, often I've experienced the nice argument, I eat animals because they taste good, before there's any real examination or challenging of that choice to go on. I mean, if you ask people, why do you eat animals? And they would say, many people do say, well, I eat meat because it tastes good. But then on further conver you know in further conversation, they might say, well, it's normal, well, it's natural, well, I know I need to eat animals. So it seems to be sometimes what's most prominent in people's consciousness, especially if they're in the process of eating it. But I don't know how it relates. I have to think about it further, because I do think that it may in fact be a subset or a kind of a sub-argument of eating animals as normal.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. A final argument in favour of meat eating is that animals have an intimate place in a traditional cycle of food production, where their manure helps to fertilise the land, which then grows crops. But couldn't we just as easily use human manure?
That's a very good question. And I mean, there are people who engage in veganic farming, who are using vegan byproducts in order to nurture the soil, in order to nourish the soil. And there is a growing movement of veganic farmers who do not buy into this belief that we actually need animal manure in order to grow plants for people to eat. I mean, that said, the vast majority of animal products are produced not by, cows that are grazing on the land that they're fertilizing, but inside factories, where what's happening is we have more production of toxic waste than anything.
Yeah. Okay, then let's move on then. So, in what way would you say carnism is vulnerable? Because it seems a very, very powerful thing.
Well, carnism, as I said, is organized against human values, core human values. And, for most people, they do seek to live in alignment with their values to the best of their abilities. When people become aware that they have a choice and aware that there are alternatives to what they have been doing, and aware of that what they've been doing or participating in is deeply problematic, most people choose not to participate anymore. I mean, we can see this with other isms. I mean, while unfortunately racism and sexism and other isms are still, very much alive and thriving today, they are being actively and increasingly challenged. And these systems are transforming, and they're transforming because people are becoming aware of them, and because people realize that they have a choice not to participate. And so, carnism is only as powerful as its defenses are. The carnistic defenses lose much of their power when we shine the light of day on them. Once people become aware of the ways that they have learned to distort their perceptions, for example, of farmed animals, they're much less likely to engage in such distortions. For example, one cognitive distortion I talk about in my book is abstraction or de-individualization, perceiving farmed animals as members of an abstract group about which we've made stereotypical assumptions. A pig is a pig and all pigs are the same. Rather than recognizing that these are individuals who have their own personality, their own character, their own preferences, and a life that matters to them just like we all do.
But there are huge vested interests as well. The meat industry and the whole advertising machine that's behind them, you know, that for us to continue engaging in these carnistic practices. It's a bit like consumerism, you know. I don't think that consumerism makes us particularly happy. We've got this trillion-dollar industry that's just shoving us down our throats constantly, aren't they?
That's right. That's right. And people seek liberation, they seek happiness, and they seek internal moral consistency. And when alternatives become more widely available, as they are, when people become more aware that they can live differently, they can make choices differently, and that the solution is actually quite simple. I mean, the solution to consumerism is very problematic, as you know, as you've pointed out, it's big business. The solution is not that simple. I mean, it's every you know aspect of our life practically is entrenched in consumerism. One could argue that's true for carnism as well, but the alternative to carnism is actually much, much simpler to choose. I mean, we simply becoming aware of carnism and making a commitment to reduce our participation in carnism. You know, I think it's helpful to see carnism on a continuum, you know, with radical carnism on one end and, you know, veganism on the other and all sorts of variations in between. And what's important, I think, in terms of social change and one's own consciousness as well, is not where we are on the continuum, but rather where we're heading on the continuum. And by making a commitment to move toward a more compassionate and more internally consistent way of eating and of living, we can make significant changes in society. If everybody did that, we would have a very different world. So simply becoming aware of carnism and committing to reducing and ultimately eliminating one's participation in carnism, and also raising this awareness, sharing it with others, can really make a difference.
So would you say that taking an incremental approach, which a lot of people are starting to do now, saying they want to eat less meat, and also they're becoming more aware of the inhumane practices, that's a good thing?
Absolutely. I think the ideal thing is not to participate in carnism. You know, for those of us who can, you know, where we have the ability to say no to carnism and really withhold our participation, obviously, you know, ideally you want to really be a conscientious objector to this system. That said, for many people, change takes time. And allowing oneself the flexibility, allowing oneself to change in a way that's sustainable is very important. And to reduce participation, I mean, you could have one vegan meal a day and then move up to one vegan day a week and, you know, one vegan week a month. I mean, however a person wants to construct this kind of a change for themselves.
Okay, so this brings me to my next question. Is it possible to have an examined relationship with carnism?
Can you describe a bit more what you mean by that?
Well, that carnism is simply not just a prejudice, that people are aware of those justifications and their limitations, but still feel that they can try to, what we've been talking about, have an incremental relationship with eating meat, and also that they would endeavour to eat animals that have only been compassionately looked after. Whether that is a possibility, that's another question. But at least that if they're attempting to do that.
Well, I think there are two different issues that you raise. I mean, one is I think it's very important to examine one's relationship with their eating and to examine carnism, one's carnism. Where that leads and how deeply one examines can be very different things. So I think reducing, you know, recognizing that carnism is inherently a problematic ideology. Carnism is an ideology that conditions us that it's appropriate to eat individuals of other species. It's appropriate to kill individuals who would choose not to be killed if they could. Not because we need to in order to survive, but because we like the way they taste. That is deeply problematic in itself. That said, so I would suggest two things. There's a difference between somebody examining carnism and saying, for me right now, it's very difficult to become vegan. However, I don't want to be as a participant in carnism to the best of my ability, and really reducing their participation in it, meaning eating fewer animal products. That's different than changing their participation in it. Reducing your participation in carnism is eating fewer animal products. Changing your participation in carnism is eating different animal products. When you eat different animal products, you're essentially saying it's okay to eat animals as long as these animals are raised in different conditions. I mean, this is what we see. I refer to this as neo-carnism, or like new form of carnism, right? It's a new way of justifying carnism. And we can see this with so-called, in the States, it's called humane meat. I think in England you say organic meat. Here in the rest of Europe, we say bio meat or bio meat. It's all the same idea, happy meat. So I think it's very important for us to, it's impossible to really have an objective conversation about eating animals until we step outside of the system, carnism, that's conditioned us to think that it's appropriate to eat certain species. So if we, for example, substituted a golden retriever for a cow or a pig or a chicken, we might feel quite differently. Or come to a very different conclusion about what's compassionate in terms of how we treat that individual. Most people, at least in many places in the world, would consider it cruel to slaughter a happy, healthy golden retriever simply because we like the way her legs taste. And yet, when the exact same thing is done to individuals of other species, we're taught to think of that as to actually call it compassionate or humane. It's hard to see the absurdity of this argument until we step outside of carnism.
Maybe it might be interesting for me to tell you just a little bit about my eating habits. I'd be quite curious to hear what you think of my position on this. I've been a vegetarian most of my adult life, and then about 3 or 4 years ago, I became a vegan, or what, mainly because I recognised that with the dairy industry, there was, as you were saying earlier, there's as much suffering going on, if not perhaps more, and there's something almost more insidious about the dairy industry, because you get things in nice little yogurt packets, and you don't see any of the consequences of what hap of the suffering there. But I do have a sl maybe I'm slight I have a slightly different view than you, in the sense it's more about identification for me than just sort of equal rights or whatever. Maybe I'm misquoting you here. For example, I have less of an issue eating a mollusk than I do a pig, for example, because a pig has personhood, arguably. It has a narrative. It can reflect on the past, and it even has can reflect on it, the possibility of its own death, etc. And so there, I can identify with a pig a lot more than I can a mollusk. Do you think it's just as bad to eat, say, an insect as it is to eat a highly sentient animal like a pig?
I mean, I don't know that couching my answer in terms of whether it's good or bad or better or worse would be very helpful. I think that, what we do know, I mean, scientists are debating the sentience of certain types of species. I mean, we know, for example, today that certain fish, anyway, and crustaceans do possess intelligence and pain receptors, for example, such that there are measures being taken to protect them from harm, from suffering and exploitation. I know that there's conversations about, whether insects, for instance, are or are not sentient, and I don't have the answer to that. I think when we're unsure of something, as the philosopher Tom Regan says, when we're unsure and the consequences are so high, we may want to err on the side of caution. I do know, however, that we have overwhelming evidence that many other species, mammals and animal species, are, or I should say, animal species are indeed sentient and do have lives that matter to them and do have self-awareness and the qualities that we would, sentience being most important in many ways. And so I think that's where the conversation needs to lie. Most people are not wondering whether they should continue eating bacon because what if an ant has feelings? And I think we want to, you know, we may want to keep our focus as we, I don't mean we during this conversation, but I mean, in general, as we talk about creating a better world, our focus on doing what we know that not eating meat, eggs, and dairy can reduce a tremendous amount of suffering in the world.
Yeah. In some parts of the world, such as China and India, meat eating is increasing. Why do you think that is, and what can we do about it?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and so you can see like big agribusiness doing what big tobacco did a few years ago and has been doing. It's exporting its problems to places in the world where people and governments are more vulnerable, essentially. And so as people in the West, for instance, become increasingly aware of the link between consuming animals and disease, people are increasingly reducing their consumption of animal products, and animal products are being increasingly marketed overseas in places like Asia and you know, some other parts of the world. I'm not surprised. I mean, this is a trajectory I would have expected big agribusiness, big animal agribusiness to follow. It doesn't surprise me at all. And the good news is that there are many vegan groups and many activist groups in all around the world that are actively challenging what's happening now, actively challenging meat eating. It's not, you know, when tobacco started, well, I don't know, I don't want to go into tobacco, but we can see the rise of the global vegan movement happening alongside, you know, the rise of carnism, essentially, in countries where it hasn't been as prominent.
And how is veganism faring in the rest of the world? Do you have any rough statistics about how it's growing?
I'm terrible with numbers and I don't have my statistics in front of me, but I can tell you, you know, having seen the statistics from people, it's pretty impressive. It's very impressive. And having been myself, just my own experience on five continents now, talking about carnism, meeting with people in positions of leadership in the vegan movement, it's tremendous what's happening. I think it's very important that we frame veganism accurately, and we see veganism as what it is. It's an ideology, and it is also one of the fastest, the vegan movement is one of the fastest growing social justice movements in the world today. And, you know, eating animals really is an issue of social justice, and I can't stress this enough. It's not simply a matter of personal ethics. It's the inevitable end result of a deeply entrenched oppressive system. And that you know, makes it an issue of social justice. And so the vegan movement is, you know, I haven't been to a continent yet where there hasn't been a vegan movement, or I should say even a country where there hasn't been, even in South Korea, where I was recently, there's a budding, I should say vegetarian movement at least, starting up there. So it's been really tremendous to witness.
Great. Okay. Well, that just thinking about that personal issue, social justice divide, and I'm definitely on the side of social justice, but where you often come across that as a vegan is, you know, is often at a dinner table or with friends, and people have very, very strong feelings about this issue. Do you have any advice how to deal with these situations? Because often it can be a real dampener on a, you know, on a social situation, but does it go beyond that?
It absolutely does. I mean, one of the things that I have written about more recently is not simply the way that carnism uses defenses to validate itself ideologically, but how carnism also uses defenses to invalidate veganism, which is the system that challenges it. And the way I call these secondary defenses. Secondary defenses are defenses that are designed to invalidate or discredit the vegan message. You know, if you shoot the messenger, you don't have to take seriously the implications of his or her message. So, you know, for example, when a vegan talks about nutrition, they're automatically perceived as biased. And yet we don't recognize that carnistic bias is like woven right into the very institutions that accredit people as you know, nutritionists, for instance. So, you know, this happens automatically. I'm not saying that people are intentionally stereotyping or marginalizing vegans, but it does happen, and it can be very challenging for vegans to feel like or to talk about the issue without feeling like they're silenced. And I recommend not talking about the issue when people are engaged in eating animals, because defenses are higher and it's just a more uncomfortable situation. All of my advocacy, as it were, comes from sharing my own story with people. You know, when people ask me why I'm vegan, I share my story. You know, I learned about what happens to the animals and the environment. And I didn't want to be a part of that. And that's, you know, changed my life for the better in tremendous ways. And, you know, so I inform through my own experience. And I find that most people are genuinely curious and most people do genuinely care.
Yeah, and that just brings me to another question there. And for many people, even if they are convinced by your arguments, they don't necessarily experience that profound shift in consciousness that you had, and often find it just very difficult as a physical thing to do, to stop eating meat. Do you have any practical advice?
Well, I mean, this shifts in consciousness are often invisible, you know, unobservable. They're not very easy to notice. They tend to happen, you know, sometimes you have this profound paradigm shift, but sometimes that profound paradigm shift is the result of many micro shifts, you know, these little mini shifts that are happening over the course of years. And, you know, people don't change until they're ready to change. You know, asking somebody to stop eating animals is not simply asking for a change of behavior. It's also asking for a shift of consciousness. And that happens only when people are ready. So, you know, my recommendation is to, I very much believe in awareness raising, and to raise awareness, and to do so. Colleen Patrick-Goudreau, my friend and another author, says the best thing that one can do when they're promoting veganism as an individual, right, is to plant seeds.
Yeah.
And the seeds will grow as they will. So plant seeds. We live our truth, you know, to the best of our abilities, live our truth and speak our truth with compassion and curiosity and open heart and an open mind, and allow people to, you know, come to ask more questions if they want to, and know that when people are ready, they will probably choose to make that change if it's feasible for them.
Okay, great, yeah. Okay, many vegans and vegetarians have an intuitive sense that they are acting appropriately in the you know, the choices they make. But I feel from your work, Melanie, that for many, I would imagine you've now provided them with a way for that to be articulated. Has that been reflected back to you?
Yes, it has. And that was one of the goals of my work, was really not simply to help people who are still engaged in carnism recognize what's going on, but also to help vegans feel more grounded in and better able to articulate their choices. It's hard to talk about this issue when you haven't actually named the problem. You name the solution, but the problem can be perceived as abstract. So yes, that is feedback that I have gotten, and I'm very grateful for.
And I think what I personally find particularly powerful about your approach is that it puts the onus on carnists to account for their actions. And something very profound, what I think you say, it's not only vegans and vegetarians who bring their beliefs to the table, it's this invisibility that you have sort of opened up, really. Was that your main intention, do you think?
Specifically with to take the focus off of vegans and put it on the system. I mean, that I think one of the ways that dominant systems maintain themselves is by remaining unexamined. You know, there's vegans and vegetarians, and then there's everybody else. You've got your belief system, but we're just normal people. They're just the mainstream. And I think it's very important for us to really shine a spotlight on, you know, not necessarily people who are engaging in carnism, but carnism itself. And one of the reasons is because also it allows for people like myself. Like, I didn't want to think of myself, I wasn't a bad person when I was eating animals.
Yeah.
I was a person who was doing what I had been conditioned to do. So when we can recognize that, you know, the real problem is the system. It's not, you know, simply the individuals in the system. It gives people the ability to make these changes if they choose to in their life without feeling like they're bad people.
Yeah. And that, well, I think you've done that. And there was a discussion on our society Facebook page recently in which someone raised an objection about the term carnism. He argued that people who have a term foisted upon them are much less likely to respond positively to it. For example, conservatives, when talking about global warming, are much more receptive to the idea when we talk about the land rather than the environment, or or even climate change rather than global warming for that matter. What would your response be to that?
Yeah, I don't see Kernism as a term foisted upon people. It's not, I don't use the term Kernist to describe individuals. I used that term originally because I wanted, for accuracy. And I choose not to use it now because people do perceive that as a term foisted upon them and can feel defensive because of that. And it's understandable because Kernism is still so invisible as an ideology that most people really are inadvertent Kernists, as it were. So, but I do think it's language, words can be used to oppress and they can be used to liberate. Yeah. And I mean, imagine trying to talk about civil rights without ever having named racism.
Racism, yeah.
I mean, you're essentially paralyzed. You know, I don't remember who said it, that the limits of my language are the limits of my world. It's a quote by somebody, and I forgot who said it. But it's very important for people to for us to name things. When we name things, we make them visible. When we make something visible, we can finally talk about it and question it.
Yeah, okay. You've talked quite a little bit about awareness. In our society, as well as focusing on specific issues, we also work on awareness in a more general sense through cultivating a range of what we call integrative practices, whether it be the integration of desire with practices such as meditation or Tai Chi, etc. The integration of meaning, especially through the arts, for example, and the integration of belief with practices such as critical thinking or working with cognitive biases, etc., and involvement in pressure groups, politics, etc., etc. Now, you've talked about integration yourself, and it's something that you feel is very important too. What does it mean to you, and how can we become more integrated, especially in respect to what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many ways, as you described some of them, to work toward integration or wholeness, essentially, yeah. Right? And so, not surprisingly, integration shares a root with integrity.
Yeah.
And integrity is the integration of values and practices. And that's really the cornerstone of the work that I'm trying to do, is to really help people to become aware of, how their values and their practices are not necessarily in alignment when it comes to eating meat, eggs, and dairy. And so that's really the focus of integration that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, okay. What is your understanding of the middle way, and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I mean, I think it's really about being, it's not simply about, what ideology or belief system one chooses to engage with, but how one relates to that ideology or belief system, how one relates to oneself, So really seeking to have a balance, really seeking to, practice the three C's of curiosity, open-mindedness, compassion, open-heartedness, and of course, having the courage to do this. It's really just being able to live your truth. And there is, and to be on a constant quest for asking, what is your truth? What is the truth you seek to live?
Fantastic. Okay, and my last question, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Absolutely, they can just come to kernism.org.
Okay, that's easy. Okay, well, thank you ever so much for talking to me today, Melanie. I think you're doing a fantastic job, and I'll follow your work with much interest.
Many thanks. It's been a pleasure. And thanks for all that you're doing as well.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.